Blog Talk Radio.
Life seems to crush your dreams, so find your balance for all your needs. A little work, some family fun. Find your love, keep your life on the run. Told you how the story goes, so write your own script before you grow old. Live your life, laugh out loud. Own who you are, stand up proud. You got
Welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast. It is Wednesday evening on August the 17th, a nice evening here in Central Kentucky, and this is one of your co-hosts, Stephen Zimmer. Just me solo for a moment. I'll be joined in progress by the amazing Daniel Dark and also Holly Phillip. She'll be joining us in progress. She had a little bit of a family emergency right before the show, but she will be coming online here in a moment. Episode number 302, just ahead. It's going to be a good one. Diana Bazork, first in the chat, and also being joined by Clayton, the man himself. He's in a writing machine lately. He's just tearing it up from what I see. And that's good to see. Good to see. Hope everybody's getting creative and you're ready for a big night. And, well, as far as I know, I know tomorrow is going to be the big night for Sarah, who just joined us in the chat room. She's heading out for that big Duran Duran concert. She's flying out tomorrow. So, yeah, wish her well. And that's going to be a very exciting trip. Hope that we get some photos and good stories when she comes back. That band gives me fond memories back in the early 80s. And Diana can vouch actually do Hungry Like the Wolf pretty well on it was like Guitar Hero or one of those kind of video games. But, you know, the kind of ones where you sing along, but I do Hungry Like the Wolf. And could probably give a karaoke treatment a good run, so maybe that will happen someday. But yeah, that's a lot of fun. And yeah, Clayton's got 7,000 words in 6 days. That's good, 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 good. That's awesome. Yeah, because he's got some great stuff. Definitely like love it getting to work and read his material. And today was a pretty cool day because we finally got things rolling for Imaginarium 20. And it's an avalanche of updates and stuff in progress. Of course, you know, we got a small administering it all. So, you know, we have to bring it out in phases. But today we went ahead and opening out there for guests up on the site. We also for sponsors and individual patrons for this coming year, individual patrons, that's the little $50 individual sponsor. And then we have 7 packages of sponsors available for those of you, companies, organizations, or individuals that like to help us make our 10th anniversary a massive one. And we're working hard to get some great going as far as our guests of honor and imaginators are concerned. And we've got some good folks that we're talking to, so hopefully we'll have some big news to share very shortly. And, of course, it'll be next year. 14th in the summer of 2023, and we will be returning to the Hyatt, the Holiday Inn Louisville East. Sorry, the Holiday Inn Louisville East. But yes, it's going to be a great, great year. And but yeah, the ball has to start rolling early. And some people will be wondering when we're going to open up for the early discounts on registrations or event tickets and expos. Be done very short, within the next few days. It's kind of a day-to-day thing. We got also entries for the film festival open. It's open now at both the International Writers Association and also for Film Freeway. So, yeah, a lot going out here. So we're going to try to kind of introduce it in bits because it is an avalanche of things opening up. But, yeah, but if you want to be a guest application, you want to submit a film, and then, of course, yes, individual sponsors, and that really will help us kickstart things strong early and allow us to hope after some really big guests, and that does help in that process. So give it a look over at entertheimaginarium.com and check that out. So that is the bit of news that I have, and I'm going to be scanning over here, looking in the chat, making sure we got, Sandy, let's see, says I've got, okay, Sandy says I'm getting some kind of tonight, see, as far as new equipment. No, I'm still using the same equipment I always do. Hopefully it's not coming across too bad there, but let's see, we got Holly Phillippe coming. I'm going to turn her mic on right here. And there you are, Holly. I hear you.
I'm here.
Hi.
Awesome. You can always hear me breathing. That's what COPD does to you.
There you go. Well, for a few minutes there. So, yeah, thanks. But I explained you had a family emergency early. So, but I was giving everybody the updates on Imagine and giving them the, you know, the good word that we have started. So, you know, as far as sponsors, patrons, and all that kind of good stuff. So, yeah, active. So, go for it. Yeah, become at least
you
become an individual
are
patron.
Cutting. Hey, you're cutting in and out.
No, I don't know what to do. Let's see.
Every
not
other
much
word
I can do. Oh, geez.
Take
know
your
what
headset
to do
off and go to speaker. Go to just the speaker.
Okay, because I bought 3 new headsets in the last 2 months, so I'm tired of buying headsets. Let's see here. All right. Okay, there we go. Straight on the speakerphone.
Much better.
Well, I guess I'm going to have to figure out what's wrong with my headsets, because that's the third new headset that I've purchased in the last 2 months, and they're all rated well, and they weren't inexpensive, and
I'm wondering if it's not the headsets. You need to let me try them. You need to I'll call you or something. We'll figure it out afterward. But I think it may be the phone. I think maybe your port's dirty.
Yeah, it could be that. I mean, it could be that. That's possible.
It's not getting a good connection, you know what I'm saying? The joys of live radio, guys.
Yep. Always an adventure. Always an adventure. But, again, hopefully did you all hear me out there? Say it in the chat room. But I was going over all the aspects of Imaginarium that are open. Guest applications are live. Film festival entries are live with Film Freeway and International Screenwriters Association. We also have, of course, sponsorship packages. I can't say enough how important those are. There's some very affordable ones. We have several levels that are very affordable, especially if you're looking at getting vendor space. It's actually not that much more than vendor space. And, take a look at those, like our bronze level and things like that. And then individual patrons, that's a $50 patron level. And those, they do help a lot, because we really want to bring in, you know, some really top level guests and all. But yeah, that skyrockets costs on our end. So the more sponsorship we can get at the beginning helps us to, you know, go after some of those folks. So definitely give that a look if you get a chance on the site, entertheimaginarium.com. And yes, so. All right. So yeah, I guess we're sounding better. So we'll see. Oh, man. But let's see. And thank you. As we were speaking on the phone here, I see a Sandy Lender has come aboard as a gold sponsor. So thank you, Sandy.
Yes.
You are awesome. I figured her mind would be
thank
totally
you,
in Duran Duran mode. I figured she'd be all Duran Duran tonight. But hey, you could vouch for me, Holly. I did tell the story about how I can sing Hungry Like the Wolf well in that video game that you had me do up in Indiana that one time. I don't know if it what exact game it was. Yeah, it was like Guitar Hero.
It was Guitar Hero. Yeah, on one of the older Xboxes.
One day we'll be at a karaoke thing, and Sandy will be amazed at how well I can sing "Hungry Like the Wolf." It will definitely give her a chuckle. But I actually don't do that one very bad, so that's awesome. So
I hope she has a good time. Bless her heart.
Oh, that's awesome. Yes, I hope it's good. I hope it's an awesome time. Awesome time. And speaking of sponsors, yes, tonight I want to bring you the spots from those who are bringing you tonight's show. And again, that features Sandy Lender, and she's got a brand new spot. And then also, we also got the one and only Ren Garcia. So let me go ahead and give you Sandy's new spot, and then we'll go from there. Here we go.
The latest release from author Sandy Lender is book 3 of the Fairy Holiday series titled I Know What Your Vampire Did Last Summer. It's a standalone story in the series, but it's got all the fun, humor, horror, and sweet paranormal romance you'd expect of a Lender Blender vampire satire. Come on down to the Naples Hideaway and Marina for a fun and romancy vacay. But watch out for the Grendwolves and the random femme fatale who thinks she's competing for your vampire's attention. Pick up I Know What Your Vampire Did Last Summer by Sandy Lender today.
Yes, and that features an original creature of Sandy's, so check it out. Definitely something to look at and pick up for sure. And give her some feedback on it, too, while you're at it. So well, now we'll move over, and thank you, Sandy, very much for the support. Now we'll give you a little spot with Ren and, of course, the famous question.
The League of Elder dares to be unusual. It's easy to be swept away in this bold and uninhibited landscape where fantastic heroes become old friends and sinister villains inhabit every dark corner. Dare to explore things best left alone. Each book is your lantern, lighting the path to a world never before seen. So what do you say? Are you weird enough for us?
Yes, Ren Garcia. We are weird enough.
And if you have contact with Ren, folks, start bugging him to make sure he comes to the 10th anniversary next year, because we want to see him there in person.
Yes.
Start a
we
got to
get the Garcia back in the house.
Yes. I agree. Oh, he's awesome. He's awesome. And we have some great shows coming
he
up,
awesome.
Too, in the next week. So be ready for
yes,
that. Definitely some cool guests, including in September. I'll give you a teaser. Won't tell you who it is just yet, but a very, very talented artist. We have an artist featured on one of our September shows. And also, we're going to have an encore with Bridget Nelson. We promised we'd get her back soon. She was on the night that we went haywire with the storm, and the transformer blew up and knocked out all the power, and it was just me on a battery-charged phone keeping the connection, and poor Bridget hung in there so well. And I was like, I'll make sure you get on relatively soon again to do an encore. Hopefully no storms. But, yeah.
I thought, literally, there was rotation that night, and it sucked the door out. And that's when my son Noah was still living here. And me and him both had to grab the front door because we watched the transformer go and blow up during the show. And I thought, like, the house was on fire or something. And so I go running down the stairs, and poor Bridget is on the podcast. And I'm like, oh, my God, there goes the door, because it sucked the front door open, and me and Noah had to work together to get it closed. And then I had to go downstairs, and then we lost electricity, of course. But we did finish the show. I ended up having to come back here. Stephen put it on speakerphone, and me and him sit there in the office, and we finished it. But that poor thing, she took it all in stride. She thought it was comical, but like she said, we're troopers, because by gosh, we still finished the show.
Yeah, no, we did. That was something else, and
that was crazy.
But she'll be back, and hopefully it'll be a much more relaxed visit this time. But we do have our guest on deck, and tonight I am very excited to bring tonight's guest aboard. He happens to also be the designer of the Imaginarium logo, but most importantly, he is an award-winning author, and he is the author of the Heart of the Sisters fantasy series, and he also has a brand new release, a short story collection that spans several genres of speculative fiction called The Gods Must Clearly Smile. He's also an award-winning graphic designer and cover artist, and he rocks. And that's why, you know, of course, we want him aboard. And so he's with us tonight, the one, the only, the man himself, Aaron Christopher Drown. Your mic is on, my friend. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys.
There he is.
Hello, hello.
How's it going?
How are you? Pretty good.
Great times.
If this were a visual show, I would have smoke and lasers for you, but we'll just have to imagine them and maybe audio represent them in audio somehow. But it was great to have you on the show, and got a lot to talk about, and very excited about, of course, the brand new release, The Gods Must Clearly Smile. Great collection, and you, of course, you also use your amazing talents and cover design, graphic art to design an amazing cover of that as well. So definitely excited about it. But tell us about the new release, and then we'll start breaking it down.
Well, it's a collection of short stories, as you've mentioned, and the stories they represent several years' worth of work. I didn't sit down and write the collection all at once. They've appeared in various places here and there. But even as I was writing them separately, I made an effort to for there to be a little bit of connectivity, and just for my own amusement. I was ever since I was little. And watching, and I was fascinated by the idea of crossovers, of shared universes before there was such a thing as shared universes. When I was like 6, 7, 8 years old, I would freak out when like when Fonz would show up on Laverne and Shirley, or when the Love Boat went to Fantasy Island. That tripped me out. So I've always liked the idea of that whole shared universe thing, and so when I started writing short stories, I would just throw little things in there, you know, self-referential things, when I came to realize that I had a significant body of work and they were all sort of tied together, I thought, you know what, this might make a nice collection. And Stephen was kind enough to go along with it and said, yeah, do that. And so you have it. But I also wanted to add a couple of, things, pieces to it, so that there was something new. And so it was fun writing those two things, those couple stories, and building them into the work. So I'm excited by it. I'm really pleased with how it turned out and the reception it's gotten so far.
No, actually, I mean, it's just a great, great collection. And Sandy was saying that there was a little bleed over of the delay, so hopefully I had to change to another headset. And let me know, Sandy, if that solves the problem. But yes, Aaron, it's a diverse collection. Go through a few of the stories just to give people an idea of just how distinct some of these short stories are in terms of the genre.
They run the gamut. I had a reviewer nailed it. It's so satisfying when someone gets what you're going for. And they described it as an entire season of classic Twilight Zone, all in one book. And that's always been sort of, how I view my writing. When they say, well, what genre do you write? And I see the fiction, and they don't know what you're talking about. So you have to say, it's sci-fi. But it's everything. And if it could appear on the Twilight Zone, then that's what I'm interested in. So I've got there's a Western in there, and there's There's a novella that actually runs from the prehistoric times to the far off future, and but not all of the genre. I mean, there are a couple pieces in that are straight up fiction and drama, but again, they all tie together, and that's basically. But it also stems from my adoration of Ray Bradbury and the Martian Chronicles, because that was really seminal to me. I love the Martian Chronicles. I love all these different stories that are clearly distinct, but yet play together to build one a picture, and. And that was my largest influence in putting this together.
So, Holly, I know you have a few questions tonight.
Yes, sir. Okay, what was your main inspiration for this? I mean, like, what sparked the original idea? Or have you been sitting on this for a while, and then you thought, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to add this and this, and I'm going to get a hold of Stephen?
A little of both and a little of everything. I was, like I said, I just kind of sat down. Well, actually, it's a bit of guilt because I owe Seventh Star Press at least two more books, and and Stephen has been just saintly in his patience. In my delivery of my work. But at the same time, just to keep the wheels moving and to have something out there, and to kind of restoke the fires. And I won't go into the long, long story. I mean, there are lots of reasons why my output has really dwindled to a trickle. But I just took an inventory of my stories and said, you know what, I've got like 50,000-60,000 words, and that's like a book. I wonder if Stephen would be interested. And so I reached out, and he said, yeah, definitely, and for all the same reasons. You know, maybe this will, like I said, rekindle the fires, and it has. I've been really working hot and heavy on, for real. I really have been working hot and heavy on my other books. But the idea, though, came from the central idea where I got the title from, even though there's a short story that bears the title of the collection. But the title, The Gods Must mm-hmm. Clearly Smile, comes from a quote from Aristotle. That said, if some animals are suitable, some animals are good at hunting, and other animals are suitable for hunting, then clearly the gods must smile on hunting. The cover illustration is sort of a play on that, where you've got this monster on the back cover that represents the universe in general. Coming in, for the kill of this happy little scene of a cute little cottage, on a little floating island, and it's my little tongue-in-cheek quasi-pseudo nihilism of the universe is out to get you. But anyway, so that was the idea for the centralizing thing brought it all into focus.
And it looks like we have the Dark One. So actually, it's perfect time to wrap up your comment here, and we'll bring in Daniel Dark.
Yeah.
He's here.
All right.
He has joined us in progress. Daniel, you're on.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that, guys.
Hello. You're fine, sweetie. Glad to have you. Aaron is on the show, in the house.
But I know the answer to this question, Aaron, but I'm going to ask it just on behalf of the audience. But as far as the collection goes, can you give us a little breakdown of the stories that existed kind of in the can already, and then any stories that were written specifically for the collection? I know you've talked about, you know, you realized you had a body that would make a book, but were any of the how many of the stories were unreleased? How many had been previously published? I'm just asking that for the audience.
I wrote two pieces specifically for this release, and they are it's actually one larger story broken into two stories. The first part is called The Shogun of Nelson Avenue, and that title came from one of my nicknames for my wife's dog Maggie, who was just the toughest little meanest dog on the street. And which is where she lived on Nelson Avenue. And I don't know if you've seen it, but they've got these – they actually sell armor. They sell plastic Shogun armor for pets. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I have to get some of these. We have to get some of these for Maggie. We never did, but because that's when I started calling her the Shogun of Nelson Avenue, because she just sort of patrolled. She didn't really go for a walk. She was a little Shih Tzu Moppet, you know, mop-looking thing who was, you know – anyway, but she had no business being as authoritarian as she was. But anyway, that's where the title came from, The Shogun of Nelson Avenue. And then the second part of that is the final story of the book called The Garden of the Ineluctable Void. And I got that from where did I get that title from? Gosh, I don't remember. I think it may have been something from Joseph Campbell, who I'm also a big fan of. But of the pieces, of the stories in there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, there are 14 stories total, but 10 of them were published in other forms in other places. So two of them are brand new, and two of them had not been published elsewhere, but they weren't necessarily new. And yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I think you started something now. They're mentioning in the chat room now that there's also Roman-style armor for pets as well. Clayton mentioned that. So I'm going to have to look into this for Albert.
Oh, we got to look this up.
Yeah.
Oh,
we've got to look this up. I want little samurai swords. Although we take them away at night because sometimes I don't trust that.
Oh no! No, because
Albert, we have little Mr. Prince Albert that will at night. Queen Victoria will kind of leave you alone, except for walking on you or something. No, Mr. Albert will bite your elbows if you do not let him out in time. Because we close the bedroom door at night, so they're in here with us and our bathroom. You know, they got two rooms in here, but they act like, oh, my God, it's awful. And then you let them out like at dawn, and then they go running down the hall, and then they usually come right back in anyway. But if you don't let him out in time, he will bite you. So I don't know about giving him a samurai sword.
Yeah. That's too good. But, you know, we'll have to have Aaron come visit sometime. Maybe he'll get inspired to do a story about our cats and armor with swords.
That'd be great.
Nice.
But now the book is out, and of course available in both paperback and also all ebook formats. Could you give us a little early feedback on how you've got an upcoming blog tour? I might mention that if you are a blogger at tomorrowcomesmedia.com, you can sign up for Aaron's blog tour that's coming up at the end of September and going into October. Definitely be reviews and blog posts and interviews and all kinds of cool stuff. Great way to really get in to know his work on a deeper level. But it has been out, has had readers, and it looks like we have a couple of your readers actually in the chat room tonight. So tell us a little bit about how the early response to the collection is going, especially since it is a very diverse range of genres.
Oh, I've been floored, and and because of my lingering, my pervading imposter syndrome, deeply suspicious of the incredible positivity of the responses and reviews. People who don't normally read short stories are finding it and commenting on how I don't normally like short stories, but this is great. And someone compared it to Neil Gaiman, which I thought was, you know, awesome and, you know, ridiculous at the same time. And someone said that the entire book should be a mini series, you know, like an anthology series. And I thought, well, that would be great. You know, every short story could be just a little, you know, hour long episode. And I said, that would work. But, I've just been, people have been so kind and, receptive, and, I just hadn't really prepared myself for, the warm reception it's received.
Wow.
Yeah. That's awesome. Congratulations.
That's a good problem to have.
Yeah, that is. And you've been getting out there a bit. Of course, we got to see in person at Imaginarium, and you had an absolutely gorgeous booth, and I've got a really good picture of you at it. You may see that on the Imaginarium site too. It's a great picture of you. With that being said, how have the events been going? Because I think you have done some bookstore appearances, I think. Give us an overview of how the live events have been going.
Well, the live events actually haven't been all that numerous because folks are still trying to figure out, how to, you know, reincorporate those sorts of things, live events, given that we're still at the tail end of the pandemic. But also, the timing hasn't quite worked out. And this is a discovery on my part, not being in the publicity end of things very much, but most independent bookstores and things, they have a window of 2 to 3 weeks, you know, post release, that they will book, you know, events. And after that, they sort of move on. But so I missed the window with the bookstores, but I've been booking a lot of convention and conference appearances. I've got there's a new one out in North Carolina that I'm doing in February. I've got one lined up for up in Ohio in May. Then of course there's the next Imaginarium coming up, and I got invited into LibertyCon in Chattanooga next year, so that's exciting. And my encyclopedia of conventions and conferences is kind of thin, so I'm sort of building up my familiarity and knowledge of what's out there, and places I can go, and places that would be suitable and acceptable for an author to appear at. But nonetheless, there are all sorts of online venues, and I have hit up a joined arms with a couple of different marketing places that arrange for reviews and reading groups and things like that, and where a lot of the feedback has been coming from. So I get this wider range of reader that, you know, outside the normal bounds of conferences and conventions and things, folks that are just, you know, out there reading books because they like books, and I'm excited about the apparent crossover, you know, appeal that the collection seems to have.
Yeah, because this collection, I mean, appeals to a wide range of readers. Just does. So, yeah, no kidding. But yeah, Holly, you were about to.
Well, I have a question. What was the hardest portion to write for you? Did you find the one you got like hung up on, or the one that caused you a lot of emotion, or just elaborate. What was the hardest one?
Well, I think it was actually the last two, the pieces I wrote specifically for the collection was The Shogun of Nelson Avenue and The Garden of the Ineluctable Void, just because of, even though the character is female, there are a lot of autobiographical elements to it. And and I'm the kind of writer that, I'm sort of a born-again or a reformed pantser as opposed to a plotter. And I'm along for the ride, you know, looking forward to seeing how the story turns out, you know, as a reader might. And and this went into some personal places, but I knew I was onto something when my wife, who is much tougher than I am, when I made her a little misty in some places, and it's like, okay, yeah, I got it. I don't know. I mean, there's a little bit of me in every little story, and as I imagine is the case with most writers. I think part of it was knowing that those last two stories were being written specifically for the collection, and it had been a while since I'd written a short story, and I wasn't quite certain how it was going to turn out. But I think they turned out. I think they turned out pretty well, if I do say so myself. At least I'll say I'm pleased. I'm pleased with how they turned out.
Very nice. Hmm. Very nice.
Well, I think that's true too. If you read enough of a writer's collection, you know, you do find out about the writer. You can get a really good glimpse into the mind and personality and, you know, different things of their character in their books. It, you know, it just bleeds through, you know, as a writer, because you're putting your soul into this. You're putting, you know, it's coming from your subconscious. It's coming from your mind. So it's coming from you. It's a part of you. Yes, it's elaborate, and you add all this, you know, other things that are fantasy and fluff, but yeah, there's a part of you in every story. Yeah, with any writer, I believe.
Yep, and that's why I think a collection like this is so interesting, because, you know, he's has told stories in so many different genres in one book, which that's definitely cool. So let's see, Daniel Dark has been a little quiet tonight, but I know he's got a big week going on. But
he's tired. He
like
had
to,
a big day today.
Yeah. What would you like to discuss with Aaron tonight, Daniel? Because I don't want to leave you out of the convo here.
Well, when you look through the anthology that you got going, is there a story that you could place yourself into?
Let's see. Yeah, I can place myself into several of them, I'd say. And I'm trying to think if there's one in particular. Well, I think the one that is the most intimately autobiographical would be The Swing. Even though it's set in the early 1900s, it describes pretty plainly a kid having to move away from his home in Maine, and which is where I'm from, and the feelings of his missing the place are pretty much in parallel with my own. I mean, I'm looking through the titles now, and I have to say that there's I can readily place myself in just about all of them.
Is there one that you would really like to place yourself into that, you know, doesn't exist?
Is there a is there a story I've yet to write that I would like to place myself into? Is that the question?
Right.
I don't know. If there were, then I would probably sit down and write it, and then I wouldn't have that, I'd scratch that itch. So, I tend to be that if I have any sort of that sort of wistfulness or a need for fulfillment, then I'll write it out and be done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What is your difference on a one that you have a wistfulness to one of them that you're just writing because that's what you need to write?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of the question.
What is the difference in between your timelines on your writing on one that you have a pure desire to write over one that you're just writing because that's what you have to write?
Well, I tend not to write things that I have to write because for me, writing is as far from a job as it gets, and that's partially by design. I remember hearing a story about I can't remember who it was. It was a mystery writer, someone, a Philip Marlowe or somebody like this. But that was Private Eye, the guy who wrote Philip Marlowe. But anyway, he was so disciplined in his writing that he said that if he wrote from this time of day to that time of day, and if he finished a book, typed the end and yanked the paper out of the typewriter, and he had still 10 minutes left on the clock, he put the sheet of paper in and started on the next book. And I just can't imagine that sort of regimented discipline. Anytime I sit down and write, it's going to be because that's what I want to be writing. And that's what, coaxed me to sit down and write in the first place. And I've been lucky in that regard that I don't, because I'm a graphic designer in my adult life. I that's my job, and so that when I write, it's almost always it's been always for me, and I haven't been in the position of having to write anything, that I just wasn't really personally invested in.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Very much so. Do you ever put any Easter eggs in your books? Things that only your close friends or your relatives may pick up on. Do you ever throw those in any of your books?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I lots of little asides and things I put in just for, to make myself chuckle. What's that?
Nothing. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you'd ask something else. There's a little bit of crosstalk or something going on, but, all the time. Things for my amusement, things that one or two people might pick up on, or things that they may never pick up on, but I know are there. And I do that all the time.
That's fun.
Now you brought
I
up.
I always enjoyed that. Stephen does that.
Of course, Holly. But,
I said you do that.
Yeah, I do. But you mentioned, as far as your writing goes, I'm actually curious on this as well. What is your process? I mean, do you have a typical pattern each week, I know you got a full plate on your graphic design schedule, and do you have to find just simply windows when you have time, or do you have a definite kind of pattern to your writing schedule? And what's it kind of like now? Give us a picture of that.
I try to get up. I try to write in the mornings. I my office hours for my design work usually start around 10 a.m. And so that gives me 2 or 3 hours in the morning, to wake up and get some coffee and sit down and clear the head. And so I do that almost every morning I'm working on the book up to a certain point. And it's because it's nice and quiet. I mean, the clients aren't, you know, sending me emails yet. And, you know, I enjoy the mornings to write. I used to write at night a lot, but I'm older now. I can't do that. But because you reach a certain age where 9 p.m. is like, oh, my gosh, 9 p.m. I'm tired. But unless my design work, I mean, the past couple of weeks have actually been really swamped with my design work, so I've had to put in full days. But yeah, that's my pattern. I do a little bit of work for a couple hours every day.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, I'm always curious with different writer's patterns.
I think the question was really the publisher making sure I really am working on the next book.
So I'm excited about that. We're going to get into that. But yeah, you mentioned that, you know, your graphic design work, and you do a lot of work for, you know, I mentioned that, yeah, you did do the cover design on The Gods Must Clearly Smile, but you also do a lot of work for other authors, including Mr. Dark's first book, Knife Spell. That's one of yours. And it has Daniel actually kind of make a little sort of cameo in that one. So yeah, you do get to work with other authors through your art as well as a graphic designer. And I think that's kind of cool.
Oh, I love designing book covers, it's time consuming, and so I can't always do it when I would like, but because it does take so much time, and I can't/don't charge, you know, as much as I should or could, because I like the idea of giving back to the independent, you know, community, and trying to, you know, just give a little, you know, put a little back in that's been given to me by, you know, offering somebody the chance to have, I mean, this is going to sound a little bit of conceit, but to offer the chance to have something, you know, give somebody what I think is a really professional book cover that they may not be able to otherwise, you know, go out and, you know, and pay for, you know, directly out of pocket. But yeah, I appreciate you saying so.
Yeah, you are meticulous. Mm-hmm. I love how meticulous you are when it comes to your work. And I'm going to go ahead and segue now into another book that has your cover, beautiful, beautiful cover work of yours on it. And that would be book one of the Heart of Sisters series, Mage of None Magic. And I love that series. I'm definitely looking for book two. I like it because it has a unique kind of take with kind of concepts of science and magic kind of fusing together in that world and story. And I'd like for you to take a little time to talk about that one too, because that's a superb book and series. And I'd like you to describe the science magic dynamics in your own words.
Well, I appreciate that as well. That was Mage of None Magic was my first novel, and it's meant to be the first of a series of how many I don't know, but I think it may be breaking up into maybe a couple different trilogies if I live that long. But because as Stephen can attest, it's been a number of years since I wrote the first book, but. The general concept is sort of two-pronged. On the back of the book, it asks the questions, you know, the question is, what's unbelievable when magic is a fact of life? Because I want them to know, you know, if you live in a world where magic and monsters and, you know, and miracles on demand are a thing, then what does it take to, you know, to press or to invoke some incredulity? Where it's, you know, what's it going to take for someone to say, what? That's nuts. I don't believe that for a minute. And the other thing was, the other question I wanted to answer was, why is the quintessential fantasy genre, you know, milieu, the setting, why is it always or typically a sort of a medieval, you know, type level of technology? Why is it that that's the first thing you think of is swords and sorcery? You know, why is it always swords? And I did some thinking, and it occurred to me that the balance of that equation is the sorcery, swords and sorcery. The reason that it's swords mm-hmm. is because of the sorcery. I mean, if you have instead of developing clever ways to irrigate your crops, you know, to get the water from here to there, or to, you know, fly from, you know, get something, you know, deliver something from here to there, you know, quickly. If you could just ask a, you know, hire a wizard to do it for you, to cast a rain spell or to, you know, teleport something or, you know, whatever, then there's no really need. There's no real need to develop a analog technology to do the same work. And so there seems that there's a lack of inspiration to further, the societal development. And how long could that possibly go on? I wondered. You have centuries can go by where they just sort of stagnate, where the levels of technology just stays at that same, you know, swords and shields type of thing. And I wondered, if magic is to blame for that, what if the magicians, you know, what if it was by design? What if the magicians realized that they benefit, you know, by keeping the society at a certain technological level? And I started thinking about, you know, them being sort of, magicians colluding in sort of a mafia-like way, or even in the same way that the ancient medieval Catholic Church colluded to keep the peasants illiterate, so that they controlled, you know, the dispersal of knowledge and in the written word. And so formed the foundation on which I based this this otherwise typical swords and sorcery world.
Yes, and did it well. And yes, can you give us a little teaser? I mean, I know you can't drop any major spoilers, but can you give us a little teaser about the second volume for those that may have read book one, and what's in a roundabout way? What do we look forward to in book two?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm really hoping to be done by the middle of next year. It's turning out to be a longer story than I anticipated. And because it's being book two, you know, being the middle of a trilogy, most likely, it's difficult. You know, I discovered it's difficult writing the sequel, because the first book, you know, you're establishing all the rules and you're just kind of making stuff up as you go. But then which is great and fun, but then it comes time to sit down and write the next story, then you've got to follow all the rules that you created. And it slows things up a bit. I literally had to stop and reread my first book, because there was something I needed to know where a certain item was and what happened to it. And for the life of me, I couldn't remember. I had no idea where it went, and I needed it. I needed to know where it was. And so I literally had to stop and read my novel. And they're like, oh, there it is. Okay, that makes sense. But because it had been so long. But the title of the coming book is called Book of the Hated One, and it takes the characters in the same way that I asked the question of, you know, why is it, you know, that, you know, the, you know, why are swords and sorcery. I wanted to know what happens, you know, to these characters when they go through a heroic journey, and then afterward, you know, dealing with the aftermath and the changes and the scars and the wounds to the body and to the psyche, as well as furthering, you know, the overall or overarching story, the larger picture, and discovering that the characters are not in a very good place, which works to my advantage, because, you know, the second act is usually the darker of the three, and uh, uh, so So it's good that these, you know, and I'm trying to, not trying to, but I'm finding that these characters are, yeah, they're just like I said, they're not in a good place, and they're trying to keep it together, and yeah, and they're going, and I think they're going to be, I'm hopefully that they've undergone some changes, and that's going to be reflected in the story, that these are now different people than they were in the first book.
Yeah,
I have a question from the chat room. Clayton is asking about, do you write stories based locally like Stephen King does? Because he has a story, Clayton did, that he wrote about colors. He spelled it C-O-L-O-U-R, and he said he's never actually been to Maine. So, you know, he's seen that you actually are from Maine. So do you tend to – do you write stories, like, from what you've locally, you know, known or lived?
No, not – I mean, yes and no. I pull elements from things, but no, I don't. I actually set my stories in any particular place that, you know, like Stephen King sets a lot of his stories in Derry or
right.
What's the other place? I can see the gosh, I can't remember now. But Castle Rock.
Right.
No, I don't. And I suppose that's from, you know, growing up a Navy brat and living all over. You know, my life is filled of a crazy quilt of places and people and places. And so, and that, I think that's sort of, I think that is the, what informs my writing more than any deeply rooted, I mean, Maine for me will always be home. No, that's really for me, and I don't really feel the need to explore any real world locale, you know, that I've been to in that way. If that answers the mm-hmm. question at all.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, because like you said, Stephen King does use the Castle Rock and Derry. Of course, you know, he does use a few towns over and frequently. Because then he'll look at the local legends. He's went there. He's, you know, done a lot of historical, you know, got a lot of historical data about the area and all that. So, yeah, it makes sense. I mean, some people utilize that, and some people, you know, don't feel that need to. So, yeah, that's what Clay was asking, if you actually did use the local, you know, locales.
No, I mean,
in your books.
Yeah, I will steal places. You know, there are houses and bridges and streets and things that I'll describe, you know, that actually do exist. Mm-hmm. But I won't
right.
identify them as such.
Uh-huh. Gotcha. Makes sense. Do you ever have you ever been on a? I've got an odd question, but have you ever been on? It, you come to me. We was talking about the local stuff, like a pilgrimage from like a favorite writer of yours. Say, like, this writer writes, you know, all these stories from this one locale in London or this one locale in San Diego, or I don't know, I'm just throwing out places. But have you ever actually, like, visited places? Like, I've always wanted to see the Anne Rice House in New Orleans, for example. Have you ever actually, like, went to one of your favorite writers' places?
No, I mean I've been to Walden Pond, and I've been and the Anne Frank House is actually some place that is on my list to go.
Yeah.
The closest I've come to that was I was in London a few years ago, and just walking the streets of London, and especially I think it's in the southern part near actually not the southern part, but near actually around the Thames. There's an actual wall from the old Roman city Londinium that's still standing that I'd always wanted to go see. Actually, I mean, I went to go see Stonehenge too, and that's another story. Because I'm growing up as a kid, I was just hot and heavy into the Arthurian legends, and so Just walking, yes, just walking the streets, walking the streets of the city, you know, it's over 1,000 years old.
Right.
Did it for me, and going and laying my hands on that wall was quite a thrill. And so that's the closest I think I've come to that sort of a thing.
Yeah, I did.
Well,
I
that
did
is
that
a
too,
cool
Aaron.
Story,
Aaron. I put my hand on that same wall. I went on a trip with my
oh yeah really
sister,
oh wow
and I know exactly what wall you're talking about, and I made
that's
sure
so weird.
Sure that I put my hand on that. Yeah, and that reminded me too of just how it felt to visit Bath in when I was in England as well.
Oh,
for
yeah.
The Roman
I was
there
too. And, oh yeah, walk yeah exactly. You walk. I mean, you're walking on these streets and these stones that you just know for a fact that you know people were walking. You know, because there it is. It's a city. And
thousands of years ago. Yeah.
Exactly. So.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's crazy.
Yeah, Bath was amazing, and yeah, they had one.
Well,
area
let me
where
ask
had
you this then.
Gladiatorial fights and the gladiatorial. That was kind of eerie to think about. That was standing on the same ground as, you know, where gladiators actually did fight. And, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's. Oh, I was going to ask. It's actually for both of you. Then that come up. Did when you come home from there, did that inspire you to write a story or novel? Did that inspire you to write about, you know, that area, or did it spark something?
No. No, but I did make a point of visiting, though, the we talked about Daniel Dark's book cover I did for him, the photo illustration I did for him is actually a composite of an actual archway that is on the River Thames, and I went in that and stood in that actual archway, and I think I even sent them a picture. To Stephen and Daniel, just to show them, you know, that I actually stood in that very archway, but no, I haven't. You know, that's not really where I draw my inspiration from in that sort of way. I just I love to travel and I travel for the sake of traveling. It's it. So yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I would love to. That's what I said. I just told him in the chat room, I've never left the Midwest or the South area of the United States. So I've been landlocked.
Yeah. You got to have fun. I mean, Aaron will appreciate this. Aaron will appreciate this, but I held up a whole bus full of people so that I could complete a circuit around the base of Caernarfon Castle in Wales. Yep, I held them up. I had to do it.
I would have too.
So, yeah, that was something. But go ahead, Holly. Sorry.
Oh, I said, yeah, I would have too in a heartbeat. I mean, that's just, yeah. I mean, we only live, well, you know, this life in the meat suit. So, you know, you got to make the best of it. And to be able to travel, yeah, it's just something that I would love to do one day. Maybe.
I see,
if I live long enough.
I have a response to something in the chat. I guess this is Clay, who says that Stonehenge has nothing to do with the Arthurian history off by 2,000 years. That may be factually true, but the legend is that Merlin floated the stones. He went and looked for something called, I think it was called Giant's Dance or something like that, and he actually moved the stones to their present location for as a memorial for something to do with Uther Pendragon. So yeah, I mean, obviously the actual location has nothing to do with Arthurian legend, but the legend is the key, the term there.
Yes.
And when you're a 10-year-old kid and you've seen Excalibur for, you know, for the 12th time, and you know that's where King Arthur stood right there and talked to Merlin. So yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if Holly was done there with that. But Yeah, and I'm a big fan. If you're talking about the Excalibur movie from the early 80s, that was awesome.
Yep.
I watched that so many times myself, but great, great film. But moving on, like Holly did bring up about traveling, making pilgrimages to authors that you read or are influential to you. That is a good question. What authors are influential to you as a reader, and from your early days and to now?
Well, I've mentioned Ray Bradbury. He is a huge inspiration to me and influence. I just love everything about him. And in fact, a lot of the stories in this current collection, The Gods Must Clearly Smile, start with the word "the" is because of an article I read by him from decades ago, where he said that he couldn't think of it. He was needing some inspiration, or he's looking to get started writing short stories, which is where I was at the time. So he just made a random list of nouns and then put the word "the" in front of all of them and then wrote a short story with that as the title.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's great. And I gravitate to those. I'm speaking of Stephen King. I think that I've been a fan of Stephen King since I read Cujo when I was 13 years old, and it scared the piss out of me. But I think his Dark Tower series in 50 years, or 100 years will be celebrated as a milestone of American literature. I really think it's quite remarkable. Because his grasp of his use of language is the everyday common man's language. It's not florid, it's not very ornate at all. But every now and then he'll turn a phrase that's just exquisite. Hemingway is a big influence. His economy of language, I really envy. Who can get away with using the word "nice"? He had a nice bottle of wine, and you're like, oh, that's brilliant. I read a lot of nonfiction. I'm drawing a blank now. What's his name? John Meacham. John Meacham. He wrote a book called The Art of Power about Thomas Jefferson that just had no business being as beautiful as it was for a nonfiction scholarly work. It's wonderful. And I just finished The Night Circus what's her name? I'm so terrible with names. I'm the worst with names.
I understand.
I just put it back on the bookshelf here, and her name is Erin Morgenstern. And it was beautiful. It was really, really beautifully written. I really enjoyed her writing very much. And again, it's one of those books where you read and like, oh my gosh, I wish I'm so jealous that's perfect. It's a perfect way to describe that thing. My dad introduced me to the first science fiction novel I ever read was Dragonflight by Anne McCaffrey. I'm looking at the copy right now that my dad loaned to me, when I was 8 years old, and it just blew me away. And from there, I went to Isaac Asimov, and then I read The Once and Future King by T.H. White, and just fell in love. I'll tell you, the writer I hate though is Nathaniel Hawthorne. In case you were wondering, I can't stand him. And it's funny though, because he actually went to Bowdoin College, which is in Brunswick, Maine, which is where I'm from. And he actually wrote a short story, Nathaniel Hawthorne did, about an ancestor of mine. The story is called Drown's Wooden Image, and it's about a guy named Deacon Drown, who was my ninth great uncle. Shem Drown, was his name, in the early 1700s up in Boston. But nonetheless, even though he wrote a short story about Uncle Shem, I can't stand him.
That's awesome. Yeah, there's a few popular authors that I don't click with sometimes either, but yeah, I understand how that goes. Now as far as your upbringing and, you know, your development of your creative talents, I mean, you've got two areas that you're extremely, you know, proficient in, art and then writing. Did they develop concurrently, or did one precede the other? How did your artistic path flow with both of those? I mean, you've essentially got two paths that you have in your world. So how did they flow
from
a young age up?
Yeah, I think it started with, as is the case for so many guys, you know, white men our age, with Star Wars. And when I saw Star Wars at age six, you know, for the first time, and just, you know, destroyed me, And I immediately appreciated, I don't know how, but it just immediately resonated with me, this, not just the story, because the story, mesmerizing, but the visuals and how the visuals and the story work together. And in my own way, I've emulated that, in that my graphic design work, especially with illustration, the photo illustration that I do, but even in something as simple as magazine layout, as relatively simple, as straightforward as magazine layout, the goal is to take all these disparate elements and find a commonality and build in a through line and assemble them, and find the metaphor, find, you know, the story that's there, and it's like pouring water from one glass to the other, back and forth between my design work and my writing, because a lot of the sensibilities, the same sensibilities, are engaged and employed both sides of the coin there. But it started with Star Wars, and where I just appreciated the fusion or the importance of the image and the word. But rather than going to filmmaking or anything, I grew up writing my own little short stories, which were all, of course, just various blatant ripoffs of Star Wars, and drawing. You know, I was a doodler and drawer, and I just kind of did them both. I never did them both together. I never really had an interest in, like, say, doing a graphic novel or illustrating a story. But they were separate but yet parallel tracks, two sides of the balance pole. That's just how I've always done it. You know, just. It's because they say it's easier to, you know, it's like carrying groceries. It's easier to carry a heavy bag of groceries in each hand rather than just have it in one hand only. And so my art is,
right,
is the heavy bag in one hand, and my writing is the heavy bag in the other. And that's what sort of keeps me balanced.
Yeah, it's interesting. I find it interesting. You mentioned it, but, yeah, you've ever had the itch to do a graphic novel that kind of fuses both. That is interesting. I do. That is cool. Daniel, Holly's having a check on something with her family at the hospital, but what would you like to ask here, because we're getting down to just about 15 minutes or so. Daniel, I'm not sure. Daniel's still with us?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I had a phone call coming on my other phone. I put this one on mute, so.
Yeah, another one too. Oh man, everybody's getting it. but just want to make sure that you got a chance to ask it.
What else
wanted to cover? You got about 15 minutes.
In your cover designs, like you did my cover design, what did you use as inspiration? What do you use as inspiration for each cover design? Is there something in particular, or do you sit there and just look at the job and say, this is what I need to use?
When it comes to cover illustrations, you know, book design, I like to talk with the author. I rarely have actually ever read the story I'm designing for because I just don't feel the need. I feel it's just as informative, if not better, just to talk with the author and ask certain questions. Like, because I'm looking for the overall, as I said before, the overall metaphor. In my panels and in my workshops I've given, I described there are two basic schools of thought there seems to be when it comes to cover, you know, book covers. There's the movie poster mindset, and then there's the album cover mindset. And I lean pretty heavily toward the latter because I think the abstract metaphorical approach is a lot more interesting and satisfying for me. So I talk with the author and ask things like, you know, main settings, you know, symbols, colors, places, you know, recurring images or, you know, items or things like that. And we just have a conversation about the book, you know, if I ask them, if you were doing this cover, if you were doing an album cover, you know, based on this book, what would it look like? Or things like that, you know, whatever organically comes from the conversation. And that's where I go from. It's really as simple as that.
Well, when you did mine and everything, you took two photographs, basically,
right,
and blended them.
Yep.
And then did all your other work to it to
right.
bring out everything that mm-hmm. was in my cover. You know, how did you know that's what you wanted to do?
Well, I remember, I think you and I actually had a conversation, or at least exchanged emails, and you had sent me those photographs, and I had an idea, and I know London came up, and I think that, you know, you mentioned, you know, Jack the Ripper or something along those lines, and I think it just kind of rolled out from there. So, it just seemed obvious that was the image that, you know, needed to happen. Obviously another artist would have probably, you know, come up with something different and or, you know, better. But based on our interactions and what you sent me, that's just kind of the picture I had in my head, and that's what I ended up creating. And luckily you liked it.
Really cool.
Yeah. I love that one. but it's cool. Yeah, Aaron has good taste in music, so I loved his reference to album cover approaches. He gets the vinyl thing. So, yeah, and y'all know I love vinyl. So, but Holly's back, I think, if I'm reading this correct.
I am.
Well,
I'm
okay.
Back. I'm sorry. I had to bail out. The hospital was calling me. So, yeah, I'm sorry.
But we got about 10 minutes left, Holly. What topic do we want to delve into for the home stretch? Because I don't want to, you know, ask too many questions on my end.
The home stretch. Oh, you're really putting it on me, aren't you? Well, I'll tell you what. This is a little look into authors. What are you reading right now, Mr. Drown?
He just mentioned a little bit, well, but yeah, I'll let him cover that again.
Yeah, I just finished The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern,
okay.
which I enjoyed a lot. I mean, there are things it wasn't quite what I was expecting. It didn't quite go where I, you know, thought it was going to. But her writing is gorgeous, and that was enough to keep me interested in the story. I just started another book, and I mean, literally just one chapter into it. And if you bear with me, I can tell you what it is. But I think it's called This Tender Land.
While you're looking for that, I'll follow up with my second question, is what is your favorite, most underappreciated book?
Well, that's Ooh, pretty easy. This is what I'm reading now by William Kent Krueger, and I'm just one chapter into it.
I got him thinking now.
It's pretty good. And next on my list is The City, The City and the City by China Mayville. But the most underappreciated novel is the one that got me started writing. It's a book called The Sleeping Dragon by Joel Rosenberg. It was published in 1983.
Yeah.
And I had the good fortune of actually striking up. I first read it when I was 15 years old, and it was only been out for a couple of years, and it's the book that I read it and set it down and said, "Damn, that's what I want to do. I want to write. I want to do that." And that's what got me going. Not so long afterward, I sent a couple of emails to Joel Rosenberg, just telling him, thanks, how much it meant to me. And he was kind enough to reply, and we struck up a correspondence, which became a friendship. And I actually ended up going up to Minneapolis, where he lived, and visiting him and his family and some friends two or three times.
Wow!
And he's just a great guy. I really liked him. Sadly, he passed away a few years ago. So the series that is called The Guardians of the Flame is the series, and so it'll never be finished. Two of his books, actually, that one is my sentimental favorite, The Sleeping Dragon. Unfortunately, he gets kind of lost in the shuffle because of the prominence of the thriller writer Joel C. Rosenberg. You search for Joel Rosenberg, and he's the one who comes up. But this is Joel Rosenberg, the fantasy writer. He has another book called The Shy. D'SHAI, which is just, I think, is his best book. It's just beautifully written, and it's one of my favorites. He was just really good. Not only was he a great guy, but he was a really good writer. And I go back to those two books a lot for inspiration. Those are the two books that I would recommend to anybody looking for some good old fashioned fantasy.
That's Have awesome. You ever thought about writing any fan fiction in that world?
I've written some, not really in that world per se. There was some debate amongst friends of in the circle around Joel about a certain what meant what. And we didn't agree with, we ended up not agreeing with something that Joel himself had written. And he was like, fine, how would you do it? And so we each took a turn at writing little short pieces, sort of correcting his mistakes. It was all done in good humor. But as far as fan fiction goes, I've written a couple of Star Trek stories. One was really well received. And nearly made it into the Strange New Worlds collection. But then didn't. So I got a nice note from the editor.
I love that show.
This was before the show. It was they had
before
a collection of anthologies that they would collect from different authors.
Wow.
Yeah, I've never really been, much. I mean, except for when I'm starting out. I mean, everyone dabbles, but I would rather just do something, on my own, rather than play with anyone else's toys, I think.
Right. Yeah. Well, coming up here in about 5 minutes left, so want to give you a window to tell everybody how they can connect to you and find all the good stuff like The Gods Must Clearly Smile and A Mage of None Magic and everything else.
They can find those on, of course, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or order through your local bookstore, even better. You can find me on Instagram at Aaron Christopher Drown. You can find me on Facebook at Aaron Christopher Drown. And from there, and or you can find me on the website, which is AaronChristopherDrown.com.
Nice and succinct, yes, right across the board. And but also I do want to slip in there too. There was a lot of discussion tonight about independent bookstores and signings and things like that. Folks, if you have a half price books in your area, they are great to work with.
Yes.
I have repeatedly heard from all over. Yeah, folks have always had a great experience.
Well, we use them here.
Every place that we're aware of also lets you keep they don't actually do a split with you. They let you keep all your sales, which is not a common thing. So,
they don't ask for anything.
Yeah, but they are a good place to do some signings if you're an indie author. I'll slip that in real quick.
Yeah, we had an author just do one in Louisville.
Over Louisville.
The past weekend.
Rose,
yeah.
Mary Machario. And Carol Preflatish visited her. I saw a picture together
of
them. So that was cool to see. So, that's something I would throw out there for you, Aaron. I don't know if Half Price Books is down in your area of Tennessee, but, yeah, they are really good to work with. Yeah, so, well,
good
stuff to come up here and stay at the Stephen and Holly Bed and Breakfast and do some half-price visits around here.
And I'll make you some yummy meals.
Yes, and we'll cut your costs down. No hotels. But always, man, always great to speak with you. And I hope folks do sign up for your blog tour, tomorrowcomesmedia.com, because that's going to be very cool. It's really going to get into the guts of the short story collection, and kudos for doing something that has such a diverse array of genres. I mean, that's not something a lot of authors will attempt to get out there. They'll, you know, they might have a few genres, but kind of skewed toward, you know, a main category. That was awesome that you had a collection with such an array. And so encourage folks to pick that book up in print, ebook, gift your friends. Yes, order through the bookstore, because Aaron said it always helps authors. And definitely pick it up. But I'll give you the last word, Aaron. If there's anything that we did not cover tonight that you were dying to get out there, here's your chance. Go.
Buy my book. That's it. And independent authors in general, you'd be surprised. A lot of people think that independent authors, you know, that the offerings aren't as good from the mainstream, you know, big fives. But it's not true at all. There's a lot of good stuff out there, and I encourage everyone to explore and give folks a chance.
Awesome. Awesome.
Agreed.
Well, we'll have you back sooner than later, Aaron. And Holly, you can give us the wrap-up, and Daniel, take us out.
Well, thank you for joining us tonight. And we will be back next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern. And I would like to thank Mr. Aaron Drown for joining us tonight. And it was a lovely conversation.
Goes way too quick,
I'm telling you. We had a lot of fun. I hope someone learned a lot out there. I hope it inspired you. Write. You've got a story in your brain, get it out. Right. All right, Daniel, off to you.
Well, tonight you heard Aaron Drown give some insight on his forms of writing and cover design and life. And with all that being delivered to you tonight, what else do you need to find your talent, find your story, except to sit down and make it reality? Until we have a chance to talk next week, I wish you all a great writing and productive artistry week. This is Daniel Dark. signing off.